Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Carolinas are being swamped by these heavy rains and high winds from Hurricane Florence.
The best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate.
I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
I'm Warren Olney. President Trump is still a steadfast denier that worldwide increases in temperatures result from industrialization and other human activities, but he has struggled to find the right words to acknowledge some indisputable facts. Real threats do exist, not just to the environment, but to the security of the United States and other nations. Here he is in June of this year talking to Piers Morgan, the host of ITV's Good Morning Britain show.
I believe that there's a change in weather, and I think it changes both ways. Don't forget, it used to be called global warming. That wasn't working. Then it was called climate change. Now it's actually called extreme weather, because with extreme weather, you can't miss.
Okay, so whether you call it global warming or climate change or extreme weather, the dangers are undeniable. And today we'll look first at the threat to America's national security. Then we'll flip the coin and learn how America's national security establishment, the Pentagon, is contributing to the danger as well as trying to do something about it. John Conger was Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Energy Independence and the Environment. He's now Director of the Center for Climate and Security. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the vulnerability of military installations.
Sure. DOD looks at climate change from a very mission-oriented perspective. They're looking at it in terms of how can this negatively impact how they do their job today, how they're going to do their job tomorrow. So as we look at military bases, we see sea level rise and flooding impacting ongoing operations. If your runway is flooded, you can't fly planes off of it. If the road that goes, the main road that goes to your base is flooded, then even if it's a civilian road, the people can't get to work or can't get there in an emergency. You have drought and wildfire in the West, and that has caused the evacuation of bases as well. And yes, extreme weather as one facet of this overall problem. But when climate change stacks the deck and says it's going to be more likely that we're going to have a hurricane with more precipitation or higher winds, then it does put your cities and your bases in more danger. And we've seen multiple cases where there's been multiple billions of dollars worth of damage to military bases, even in the last year. And so, when you lose a base from the impact of a hurricane, for even, some shorter amount of time than forever, I mean, if it's a week or a month, that has a readiness impact, an operational impact, and a military and national security impact.
We're really talking about two things, it seems to me. Extreme weather is one thing. Extreme weather, I think, also from the president's standpoint, is kind of a synonym for global warming or climate change, something he doesn't really want to talk about. Tell us, first of all, what specific bases have been affected by the results of warming climate?
Well, and so once again, you want to be careful that you don't attribute every storm and say this hurricane happened because of climate change. But I can tell you that in the last year alone, Tyndall Air Force Base was pretty well leveled.
Where is that?
That's in the Panhandle of Florida. It was leveled last October by Hurricane Michael, and it took about $5 billion worth of damage. Hurricane Florence hit Camp Lejeune in North Carolina and did another $3.5 to $4 billion worth of damage. Record flooding of the Missouri River impacted Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, flooded a good third of the base, and did hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage. And so as these events happen more and more often, and they are happening more and more often, then that you can attribute or not the impact of climate change, but you can certainly say that these bases have a requirement to become more resilient so that they can deal with these events when they happen.
So obviously, as you said, the Defense Department is having a tough time doing its job under those circumstances. Broaden the conversation out a bit and tell us about the threats to instability around the world, which is certainly an issue for national security.
Sure. And so we can look at this from an infrastructure perspective, and it's more immediate. But as you broaden the aperture a little bit, and you think about what kinds of climate stresses or what kinds of impacts climate stress has around the world, you can look at drought in the Middle East and how that pushes the decisions of both the agricultural community that, you know, in Syria, for example, there was pretty clear evidence that because of record droughts that drove farmers into unemployment and drove them into cities where you already had a record number of refugees or a large number of refugees from the Iraq War that created the conditions for instability. And in this case, it ended up as civil war. But there are other scenarios. Sea level rise causes displacement. The drying up of rivers and lakes causes economic displacement, which leads to unemployment, which leads, you know, to violent extremist groups can weaponize that water when it becomes in scarce supply and use it as a recruiting tool to the newly unemployed and economically displaced. There are lots of examples where climate stresses cause instability in environments that are already fragile, that are already vulnerable. But there are other things, too. You look at the Arctic, and with the Arctic ice melting, and it's hard to argue that it's not melting, you know, no matter what your opinion on science is, you see what you see. Well, Russia has moved forces northward, and that's forced the United States to respond. China has more icebreakers than the United States does and is clearly moving to exert economic influence over the Arctic. And so that creates tension in a whole new ocean. The U.S. military has got to be in a position to operate in that whole new environment. And so they have to figure out, do our ships work in sub-freezing temperatures? What is the impact of on freshwater systems in our ships where we have where they're in salt water that is below the freezing temperature of freshwater? All those things. They have to figure it out to be able to operate. Do we have enough satellite coverage, et cetera, et cetera? There are other parts of the world where we have to pay more attention now that the conditions have changed, and the conditions are clearly changing. The one that I'll give you one more example. This is the one that makes me the most nervous of all of the possible scenarios, which is if you look at India and Pakistan. Pakistan is one of them, and India too, are some of the most water stressed countries in the world, and you have a situation where they are historical enemies. There's historical tension and historical dispute over this region of Kashmir where, oh, by the way, the fresh water that goes into Pakistan starts. So India has control over the fresh water supplies of Pakistan. And so if they were to ratchet that back, that would cause significant political implications. And, if tensions were to rise over water issues, what happens when both of the countries have nuclear weapons? That's part of the concern and the fear as these climate changes and climate stresses begin to change the dynamics around the world.
India, of course, has recently asserted a kind of authority over Kashmir that it hasn't asserted in the past. And those countries have had several wars since they were created relatively recently. Is that a threat to the security of the United States?
I think, it is fair to say that the United States security is threatened anytime there's instability around the world. We have interests around the globe. And so I think that, yes, it's quite clearly that the U.S. has interests all around the world. And when nuclear powers have increasing tensions, of course that has implications to the national security of the United States.
John Conger, once again, director of the Center for Climate and Security, former environmental official in the Department of Defense. So extreme weather, whether you call it global warming or not, is an extreme threat to America's national security. And I'll concede that distinction between weather and climate change. They are in many ways different. But in any case, they're already causing instability worldwide. But there is this paradox. One goal of our defense effort is the protection of oil. That's a major driver of what we call climate change and sometimes extreme weather. Turns out that America's defense establishment is the world's largest consumer of oil. Professor Nita Crawford chairs the Department of Political Science at Boston University. She's author of a recent report called Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change, and the Costs of War. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Elaborate on the introduction that I just gave you. I hope it's accurate, but tell me in more detail.
Sure. The United States military is the largest institutional user. That is, think of it, the military is like a corporation. If it were a country, the fuel use of the U.S. military is larger than, for example, Sweden or Denmark or Portugal. And because much of this fuel is fossil fuel, that means that the U.S. military is the world's largest institutional greenhouse gas emitter. Most of that's carbon, but some of it is also methane, which is a much more potent greenhouse gas. And that is a large part of U.S. government, is about 77% to 80% in any one year of U.S. government greenhouse gas emissions. So it is an important emitter.
What's being done about it?
Well, not enough, but there are some things that began in the early 2000s when the vulnerability of U.S. operations to cut off of fuel was recognized, in particular in Pakistan, when the United States was transiting oil through Pakistan to Afghanistan. It became vulnerable to disruption and sometimes attacks, and these fuel tankers were burned or they didn't make it. So the Marines in particular moved to increase efficiency, so you would have to transport less fuel. And that's good. It's translated into some reductions overall in Marine use of fuel, but it's also translated overall into the Pentagon's decreased use of fossil fuels. There could be a much greater reduction, but it has been a significant reduction, and it's quite remarkable. Even in a time of war, the Pentagon was able to reduce its fuel consumption. That still doesn't mean that it's not a large consumer of fuel. It just means that it's using marginally less fuel. And the other thing that's happened over time is that the Pentagon has moved from coal to other forms of energy generation, including now more solar.
So it is then taking some steps, but elaborate a little bit more, if you will, on how it is that in just conducting its ordinary activities, whether it's training fighter pilots or moving aircraft carriers around the world or anything else, the Pentagon uses so much fuel and emits so much in the way of greenhouse gases.
Okay, so just take the Pentagon's way of thinking about it for a moment, that they think of it as having really fuel use as having two components. One is installations, that is the bases that we've just been talking about, for instance, Tyndall or Homestead or whatever you want to talk about, any base. And then there's operational energy use. And that's the dominant form of energy use. So that's about 70% of all energy used by the Pentagon is for operations. And the majority of that is actually for planes. That is transport, fighters, bombers, helicopters. And so that's about, I think, 70% of the operational use. So that will vary in any one year. For instance, when the United States is not in at war, there's less fuel used. So if then you think about it, why is it the case that planes use so much fuel? It's simply because they're very sophisticated, heavy, machines that are meant to do things that normal aircraft don't do, or any and many aircraft don't do. So, for instance, they have to fly at high altitude, or they have to carry extra fuel, or they're refueling tankers. And so what they do is they get gallons per mile, not miles per gallon. Any aircraft is, of course, a large greenhouse gas emitter, but military aircraft are, inefficient from the perspective of fuel economy. So let's say a B-2 bomber gets 4.2 gallons per mile, or a refueling tanker, which would refuel the B-2, it gets about 4.9 or nearly 5 gallons per mile. So that's why the jet fuel consumption of the military is so high, simply because these are inefficient vehicles. But when you look on the ground, there are also inefficient vehicles, for instance, Humvees, which are being phased out, but they get about, I think, on average, about 8 miles per gallon, still not a marvel of efficiency. But that's among the DOD's more efficient vehicles. Though the Department of Defense has been moving to change its non-tactical, that is, sort of regular vehicle force to more hybrids and some electric vehicles. But for the most part, everything that we use in war, from tanks to transport vehicles to aircraft, is a big consumer of fossil fuels and therefore emitter of greenhouse gases.
Is there any one particular thing or series of things that the Pentagon could do to reduce its usage of fossil fuels?
There are many things. I'll just mention a few of them. One would be to rethink, and this is something that we should do in any case, no matter what, the number of bases that the United States has in installation. So we have thousands of buildings on installations on hundreds of about 500 bases all over the world. Many of them could be either reduced in size, and some of them could be just closed. That's one thing, so reducing installation use. Another thing is to rethink operations. You mentioned the use of fuel by the U.S. to protect access to Persian Gulf oil. Because the United States has less need for that oil for many reasons, one of which is we have more domestic sources of oil, and the second is oil consumption has been going down because of the move to alternative fuels and alternative energy such as solar and wind and hydro and geothermal, we don't really need to actually worry so much about protecting access to that oil, even if the worst case scenario were to occur, a blockage of the Strait of Hormuz. The country that blocked that strait would still want to sell the oil. The question would be the price. And I do want to suggest that not everything that happens that's bad in the world is necessarily a threat to U.S. interests. So even in the worst case scenario in the Middle East, if there were a cutoff of oil, it would not be a disaster. Certainly, we have enough flexibility in the system to absorb a shock for several months. Then by then, we would have straightened out other ways of getting fuel. So I believe that we could rethink the mission of protecting fuel, or rather access to Persian Gulf oil at the particular price that we'd like to see it. We could rethink that mission and then thereby reduce about a quarter of U.S. fuel consumption, which is oriented around the mission in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. And I think that there are other ways that we could reduce, but just think about the big ones there. You know, rethinking missions, rethinking bases. And on the margins, then you have room to move to different kinds of vehicles and make other changes, which would be, smaller, but would add up.
So we have Nita Crawford then at Boston University saying that the Pentagon needs to rethink the mission. We have John Conger, formerly with the Department of Defense, saying that the Department of Defense is a very mission-oriented organization. Now, we're going to get a response from him, continue this conversation in just a moment. This is To the Point, and we'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Foreman Olney back with To The Point. Is the Pentagon responsible in part for the very crises that it's trying to prevent? That's one of the things we're talking about today, having to do with extreme weather or global warming, depending on what you want to call it. John Conger, once again, back to you, Director of the Center for Climate and Security, formerly with the Department of Defense. What do you say to what we heard from Professor Crawford?
Well, I think without question, the DOD is responsible for a large amount of carbon emissions. It's a large organization. It's an industrial organization. It has a large number of heavy vehicles and aircraft, and it's got like 2 million people. And so when you have an organization of that size, it's not a surprise that you have the largest carbon footprint in the federal government and represent more than half of the carbon emissions of the government. There isn't anybody else to compete. There's nobody else with that size and that scope. Anita had a really excellent point when she was talking about the amount of emissions from aircraft, because that does dominate within the Pentagon's emissions profile. And if you look, even dig in within the aircraft, it's the wide-body aircraft that have the most emissions. Well, you can look at the airline industry, and American Airlines is pretty close to the DOD's carbon emissions alone. And if you add up all of the airlines, then it dwarfs the DOD. So it's all a matter of where you draw your lines, right, as you contemplate how many emissions any particular large organization is going to emit. But let's set that aside. If you're going to have a global mission, and you're going to accept a global mission with allies around the world whose interests are around the world, then you're going to have to have bases in the Pacific and in the Middle East. If there was an oil cutoff, it wouldn't, you know, maybe the U.S. would be able to have enough oil for a certain stretch of time, and that would be an insulated America first sort of, okay, we're okay, but, you know, all our friends wouldn't necessarily be. And so what is the implication in Japan or in Europe or anywhere else of that kind of scenario? Well, it's pretty extreme. And so obviously we can't allow for that sort of thing either. I wouldn't necessarily say that the U.S. is in the Middle East to defend oil, as we look at where our largest presences in combat operations are in Afghanistan and Syria, not normally places you'd associate with large sources of oil. But obviously, that's one of the dynamics of the region. It's a critical resource, and that's, you can't segregate it and separate it out. I do want to also say, you know, as the person who advocated for base closure for many, many years from within the Pentagon, and having run the program for some amount of time, I agree that we can certainly have fewer bases. I don't know that that's going to get you the answer you want as far as the biggest impact for carbon reductions. But certainly it's something that we should do, too.
Let me go back to Anita Crawford. You suggested that the Defense Department ought to change its mission. But are you suggesting that we no longer have a global mission, a global role, and that we don't, in fact, need then to worry about other nations when it comes to closing bases or protecting oil?
Well, the first thing is that the entire world, maybe the U.S. is lagging right now, but most economies are moving toward renewable energy, and at the same time trying to reduce the fossil fuel consumption. So there's that. There's much less vulnerability in the system than there was, let's say, when the Rapid Deployment Force, which became the current Central Command, was set up in the early 1980s. But I think that the larger question of what kind of position the United States should have in the world is a whole other conversation. I tend to believe that it's not necessarily the case that we need to be defending everything or protecting everything or controlling everything everywhere at all times. And that one of the reasons the United States has allies is they can take care of the issues in their neighborhood. The question of whether the United States needs a large power projection capability is for another day. But let's just talk about the 13 aircraft carriers. All of the United States aircraft carriers, which have all these really fuel-intensive airplanes on them, the 13 aircraft carriers and the more that we're going to buy, they're nuclear, right? So they don't themselves use the kinds of fuel that we're talking about. But they have about 10 ships that travel around with them to protect them, to do other functions, right? These carrier fleet groups are extremely fuel intensive, right? We could reduce the number of aircraft carriers instead of build more, and the number of ships. We could put them in mothballs and then bring them out as needed. And that would reduce fuel consumption. So I think the real savings are, yes, in operations and rethinking operations. We need a huge discussion in this country about that. And if indeed climate change is a concern, first of all, we don't necessarily need to respond to these concerns that as they arise with military force and more military capability. It might be the case that having this capability makes those worst-case scenarios more likely. Further, if there is conflict over resources such as water, or as is likely, there will be famine in coming decades, and people are moving to escape famine, we don't have to resolve those crises with military force. Military force is, in fact, counterproductive in many instances. So I think that the Pentagon's fuel consumption could go down, and it would not necessarily diminish the United States' capacity to defend its borders, nor necessarily its allies. What is a jeopardy is the capacity of the United States to run everything everywhere at all times, and I don't think that's good. We don't need to be doing that.
So, John Conger, let me go back to you. I want to give him an opportunity to respond to this, not just with regard to the carrier fleet groups, but the general idea that, in fact, we could retract our efforts to a certain extent, still be secure, and that our allies could be secure, and we could reduce consumption at the same time. What about the goal of reducing consumption, John Conger? Is the Defense Department concerned about it?
Yeah, sure they are. And efficiency is one of those things where if you increase efficiency, you're able to save some money and apply those funds to other things. We have a larger debate in this country over the size of the military budget, and then the DoD tries to do everything that it's told to do within that budget. I can tell you right now that even within the very large budget that it already has, there are things that it's not doing that it wants to continue to do. There's preventative maintenance that's not done because there's not enough money to do everything it's told to do because it's so big. And so you have to have a strategic conversation about reduction in responsibilities before you should go in and pick off particular programs. And so you don't really need this many ships or this many aircraft carriers or this many aircraft, but because it's a more strategic discussion that drives those answers. But I did want to get to one other point, which is in the context of an environment where the U.S. military is having to do all of these missions that are impacted by climate change, and whether it's its bases or it's the operations farther afield, because the U.S. military recognizes the impacts to its operations from climate change, it has become one of the most valuable advocates on climate change in Washington, D.C. When you have military officials, whether they are current or retired, and they are explaining why climate change matters to politicians that may have previously been skeptics, they listen more closely than they do to the scientific community or the environmental community. You can say this is good or bad, but it is fact that the military has become a better advocate. And so in these conversations about climate change, I think it's important also to keep in mind that the military has become an important ally in explaining the criticality of climate change, why it's important, and why we have to do something about it.
Nita Crawford, what do you say to that?
Well, that's true. In fact, the Navy's been leading, and it's not simply because of Newport and having to raise the level of the piers. So it's not just that the bases are flooding or they have had to raise piers. Yes, the Navy has been very forward leaning on this, and so have the Marines. But I think we must have the conversation, the larger strategic conversations, because climate change puts us in, we have to be in a strategic framework, right? If we accept that some amount of climate change is happening and will continue to occur, what we need to do is ameliorate, that is reduce, mitigate the worst case, the worst outcomes. And one of the ways to reduce the likelihood of the worst outcomes is to dramatically reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. The military is a place where we can reduce lots of greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's why I'm focused on it. And the military itself is, as John was saying, an ally in this.
Even though it is the biggest emitter of all, you're saying?
Well, it's the biggest emitter, single emitter, yes, of the government, and one of the largest in the world. And it's larger than most countries. Yes, it has been interested in fuel economy for operational reasons and for cost reasons. That's all fine. But what we need is a strategic vision about the overall problem here, because climate change is a national security issue. And you can look at it as let's respond to the issue, the crises as they occur. Or one can look at it from the perspective of prevention, which is what I'm talking about. Why let the worst things happen if we can do something about it? And that's why I'm talking about the necessity of rethinking the strategic footprint of the United States over the globe and our operations. And that's essential. And they are, yes, separate conversations, but they're linked by both the urgency and the fact that operationally, they're linked. We have over $700 billion now annually spent on the armed forces. Yet the military keeps telling us we're not safe enough. Well, if I was running any other industry and year after year we spent billions of dollars and yet we're not safe, then you have to look at maybe we're not doing the right things to be safe.
Let me go back to John Conger. You said that the military is a valuable advocate for dealing with climate change, that it's more trusted by politicians than scientists or environmental advocates. And yet, military spending keeps going up. Every politician has a subcontractor in his or her district. Are they going to do anything? Are they even listening?
Well, I think you've seen people listen already. So for example, you've heard this year alone, many Republican politicians who had previously been skeptical about climate change say, you know, I heard from the military and they've said this is a serious issue. And so now we're going to have a conversation not about whether climate change is real, but about what we're going to do about it.
Are we going to close down the base or have the aircraft carriers reduce their activity or anything very specific like that?
Oh, no, I don't think we haven't gotten to specific conversations like that. We've gotten past a very important threshold. But now we're going to have questions about whether we're going to focus on regulation or innovation. Frankly, my gut says we should do an all of the above, right? But when you start looking at things like that, if you're going to start picking off small parts of the military in order to focus on the carbon footprint, I don't think that's why you make those decisions. You make a decision as to how many aircraft carriers you need based on national security, and that's going to have a carbon footprint associated with it.
Let's talk about the aircraft carriers for a moment, right? We've got 13 aircraft carriers operational. At any one time, some are in the U.S. and some are out doing what they do. Usually there's one or two in the Persian Gulf. The main purpose of those carriers, you know, from the time that they began to be there was, quote, stability and then sometimes operations in war, 1991 Gulf War, the 2003 Iraq War and Syria and so on. So if we reduced the operations in the Persian Gulf, we could move down to, let's say, 12. Yes, we have to relate threats and missions to force structure, but we can do that. It's not impossible. And yes, it would entail reductions. The only way that you make significant reductions is you go through from a mission to capability. And that's what I'm suggesting we do. We don't, for instance, need this many aircraft carriers, and then you'd have a reduction. We don't need all these bases. Yes, go through them systematically and relate them to missions, but it's not impossible.
So I tend to agree that a smaller force is going to have a smaller footprint. I don't think that even if the military is the largest individual hitter, that this is, you know, you're talking about 1% of the United States emissions, which is 15% of the globe. Should we leave all no rock unturned? Sure. But the size of the military is going to be based on strategic national security decisions. That all said, that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of things that can be done. Personally, I look at, for example, if you look at the transportation industry and you look at how many aircraft are driving emissions, and I do think that the airline industry overall is significantly more of an emitter than the U.S. military. But that said, what if somebody came up with a way to have airplanes have fewer emissions? That affects not only that industry, but the U.S. military. There are people working on electric aircraft today. And there are ways to move the ball forward on a whole host of these types of things where you can make significant progress without necessarily changing the operational dynamics of your situation.
We're always being told that we're not spending enough on the military, even though we're spending so much more than anybody else. And the latest defense budget is a big increase over the last one. So realistically speaking, Democrats go along with this just as Republicans do. It's not been an issue in the presidential campaign, and it's probably not likely to be. So what future do you see? What hope do you have?
Well, there are some candidates who are interested in it, you know, among those who remain on the Democratic side. And I think that Warren has a plan for reducing greenhouse gas emissions by the DOD. But as John Conger is saying, it's definitely a larger discussion. There are things that we as individuals could do that would have a great impact and when they're aggregated across the society in reducing emissions. It has to be all of us. But I think that the key thing that I want to suggest is that the idea that there's a national security threat because of climate change, which might require, you know, a global presence and then takes again says to us that we don't really need to question the size of the military or what it's doing, is actually wrongheaded. We can prevent some of the worst case scenario from becoming reality if we act urgently now.
Let me get John Conger first to respond to that. Go ahead.
You know, I understand the point that if you had a smaller military, if you took on fewer missions, if you reduce your responsibilities, you would require you'd have less of a global footprint, and that would cause fewer emissions. That's an accurate statement. I don't know that the contribution to emissions and the contribution to effect is more significant than the defense value as the policymakers look at it. And so is that where you want to start? I don't know if that's where you want to start. I think that as a large federal government entity, you can certainly advance policy and you can say, hey, let's use more renewables and that'll have fewer emissions, or let's be more efficient and that'll have fewer emissions, or even let's shrink the number of bases we have. And that's fine because you're saying, what can I do? How can I have the same impact for less money, less footprint? Those are all reasonable management reforms. But if you want to talk about larger impacts to really move the needle, that becomes a significant impact, and you're going to want to have that in a broader context of all of the implications.
So, John Conger, when you were in the Defense Department during the Obama administration, there was a Navy task force on climate change. My understanding is that's been shut down. Why?
Well, you know, I think, first, yes, the task force climate change was closed down. The Navy's articulated rationale was that its functions were integrated into the rest of its operations, which in theory would be great, right? I mean, you don't want to have silos for every topic. You want to be able to integrate into all of the different pieces of your operation the concerns that are climate change. The problem is that I don't know if that's been perfectly done, and if we have can yet declare success and shut down the focus area and the focus task force. There's certainly things that are going on and continuing to go on within this administration, within the Defense Department. But I think I would put it this way. During the last administration, the White House was advocating for and asking for us to take steps to reduce global emissions, to find ways to integrate renewable energy, to become more energy efficient, to figure out what we're going to do about climate change. And there was a driver. And the military perspective was, well, okay, yeah, that's fine. We're going to do that to the extent that mission is taken care of and is the first priority. But when you lower your costs and you lower your footprint and you have renewables at forward operating bases as opposed to running generators, it's quieter, it's operationally better. There are advantages. And we did a lot of different things. And this administration came in and said, well, you don't have to worry about climate change anymore. And the military said, well, thanks, I guess. We don't have reporting requirements anymore, and that's generally a good thing. But we're still going to pay attention to this because it affects our mission. And we continue to focus on how do we get to do our mission better. And so we're still going to use renewable energy, and we're still going to try to be more efficient. We're still going to look to make our bases more resilient to the effects of climate change because, frankly, that's how we do our job, and we're not going to be able to do our job if we stick our heads in the sand. And so, you know, I think that there's a degree of stability and recognition and validation that comes from the U.S. military on this issue that is very important to the overall trajectory that we're on.
I want to thank you both very, very much for being with us. John Conger, the former Undersecretary of State, now Director of the Center for Climate and Security. Nita Crawford at Boston University, author of Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change, and the Costs of War. We've learned a lot on this program, and let's hope that people in power are paying attention to what it is that both of you people are saying. Great to have you with us, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Previtari. Be sure to check out our recent episode of To the Point, where we look at the problem we face, massive problem with the overabundance of plastic waste. Recycling can't do the job. Is it time to try to reduce our consumption? You can find it and all of our other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. Also, contact us on social media. Tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. Leave us a review. Contact me directly at warren.olney@kcrw.org. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Thanks so much for being with us.